Welcome, and this is another edition of Get Lit with Literature. This is Monk. Part 3, The Rare Metals War, The Dark Side of Clean Energy and Digital Technologies, Guillaume Patron. First published 2020 and text copyright 2018. So this information has been out there for a few years, but I have barely heard of it anywhere else. So that's why I'm fascinated with the book. Chapter 5, High Tech Holdup. Monopolizing mining was Beijing's first victory, but it wasn't long before China began to turn its sights to downstream high-tech industries that use rare earths. Battle of the Super Magnets. The author first encountered them in July 2011. He describes going through a factory, warehouses, storage area, bathed in pallid neon lighting. There you have it, rare earths. Greenish barrels containing lumps of gray and slightly corroded materials, samarium samples, gadolinium pellets, and other metals with perfectly unpronounceable names. After years of tracking these metals without ever laying my eyes on a single one, I felt like a buccaneer before Blackbeard's bounty. Until the mid-1970s, there were only a handful of industrial applications for rare earths and other rare metals. For their luminescent properties, they were used in lighters and camping lanterns. The scope of application first grew with the advent of color TV screens. The real game changer, however, was rare earth magnets, developed in 1983. These pure marvels of technology have become indispensable in all products equipped with electric motors, reputed to be pollution-free. We know that an electrical charge coming in contact with the magnetic field of a magnet generates a force that creates movement. Traditional magnets made out of the iron derivative ferrite needed to be massive to generate a magnetic field powerful enough for more sophisticated applications. Remember how we used to walk around with mobile phones the size of bricks, jokes an expert? Just one of the many shortcomings of an oversized magnet. Meanwhile, in the mobility industry, the race for lighter and more efficient energy had begun. Energy needed to be as light and compact as possible. Reducing the caliber of an engine meant reducing the proportions and the weight of the object in which it was used. Such progress would, without a doubt, generate massive energy savings. This very progress was made possible by rare earth magnets revolutionizing modern electronics. And this industry expert explained, this is about miniaturization. Rare earths make objects smaller. It's also about making electric engines powerful enough to challenge the dominance of internal combustion engines. It gives the energy transition and digitalization a formidable kickstart. This is precisely where the trouble started. So when he gets back into the history of that, and allure, a Japanese may have had the technology, but the Chinese had the allure of cheaper production that would allow businesses to expand their profit margins. So that's a repeating theme in here, and you would know that from reading the news for the past 20 years about all the factories, especially textiles, and how many corporations say, oh, well, we moved our workforce because it's cheaper. In the West and France, in particular, handed China the market on a silver platter. Underlying our apparent blindness are numerous instances of wishful thinking. The West has long held to the illusion of eternal scientific progress, a philosophy that has irrigated several economic sectors since the 1980s. We believe that by abandoning our heavy industries, we should focus our efforts on high-value adding manufacturing sectors while maintaining healthy profit margins. Some believe that emerging countries would continue to be the factories of the world, churning out genes and toys, while we would hold sway over the more lucrative segments. I think most people continue to believe that only blue-collar jobs would be affected by the shifts. With Chinese competition, a trade unionist from the U.S. metal industry told me, we didn't realize that we were going to lose more than coffee cup production and that the more skilled jobs would be hit much harder economically. So that's another reason part of why the U.S. economy is flailing is because of the lack of jobs. Then there's the allure of factory-less companies. Gray matter was more valued and therefore given more support to the detriment of the tool that is the lowly factory. This line of thinking led to the separation of business from factory. as the former opted for outsourcing. So that's a key thing there, the separation of business from factory. So that sense of, you know, at least that made in US or homemade or working with the tools right there, that change, that was a separation, which reminds me of the Glass-Steagall Act. Thanks to President Slick Willie Clinton, the Glass-Steagall Act tore down, that effed up the economy, because it used to be, I mean, in short form, from what I can remember, it used to be like, you know, if you wanted to invest in a company on Wall Street, you invest in a company on Wall Street, and if you want to go gamble, you go gamble. Or they repealed the Glass-Steagall Act, that blurred the line, so that created all these crazy hedge fund people gambling, like not investing in things, but just gambling on things. Gambling on the price was going to go up or down. Really became casino capitalism at that point. So here he's talking about the workforce and the shift from the, you know, more small and controlled to this large outsourced cheap labor. But here's another key thing, because again, much of the news tends to pit China versus U.S. Well, U.S. is stirring that up, but a factory worker could become famous for something he designed, was how it used to be. Then came the rejection of enterprise and the deterioration of the company image. Today, the working class no longer likes factories, which symbolize exclusion. Thus, the West and China took this path hand in hand. So, this whole thing, there's no finger pointing, folks. West and China, at some level, are in on this together. But from the 2000s, the Chinese began to use far less conventional methods, rare metal quotas that rattled the magnet manufacturers, yada yada. And then there's also this, he talks about this shift to China. Japan, the dilemma was short-lived. A London analyst explained they were starved of raw materials, so they took their technologies to China. The tactic was equally unjust for the vast majority of magnet manufacturers outside China. And then they're accused, China's accused, China is organizing official, this is a senator, U.S. senator, organizing artificial shortages and export quotas to raise prices internationally while keeping them low domestically. How can we compete when the Chinese are so brazenly cheating? So I don't know if that's accurate, but sounds plausible. This tactic was equally unjust for the vast majority of magnet manufacturers outside China. At the end of the 1990s, Japan, the U.S. and Europe made up 90% of the magnet market, but now China controls 3/4 of global output using blackmail in the form of a technology versus resources trade-off. And then there's mention of this major city, Baotou, B-A-O-T-O-U, in Inner Mongolia. Now, I don't know, but recently when the indigenous peoples went to the U.N. to speak their issues, there was a young Mongolian woman who spoke of Chinese genocide. So when I read that in this book about all this stuff going, businessy stuff going on in Inner Mongolia, it raised my eyebrow. But I can't say whether that's a direct connection, but that would be something I think worth investigating. And he continues in chapter 1, we saw the scenes of the world's rare earth's capital, Baotou. We saw its toxic lakes and its cancer villages whose inhabitants are dying a slow death. Let us now examine its glittering exterior. So there's the same formula as the cobalt red. Baotou is the rare earth's capital. City has made technology the cornerstone of its development, its centrifugal force being its close proximity to the rare earth deposits. We want to be more than just suppliers of raw materials. We want to supply more elaborate products, Yang Yi says. Western businesses that, like the colonizers before them, sought only to mine resources to generate added value back home are no longer welcome in Baotou. However, the apparatchik says, we are very open to transformation companies wanting to move their technologies to China. So that seems like a shift of the colonization to shift of colonization, but still colonization. This is where they make the magnets you have in your iPhones and iPads. The West is starting to put words to what has happened with China. Whoever has the minerals owns the industry. There is one capital in the world that could be given the title of Hell City in the 21st century. It would be Jakarta. located in Southeast Asia. 30 million people. And this is where I wrote, this is sort of like a haiku describing the weather there. The muggy heat saturating the air. The unrelenting rainfall harassing this city of glass and concrete. Place that's the biggest producer of tin. And again, the choices of whether it's the materials or the labor, obviously the bottom line is increase profit. So that is what drives a lot of the stuff, the increasing the profit, which is not breaking news. And in the next chapter of the day, China took over the West. These contentious metals have laid bare a battle of invention. Today, nations are competing for the brightest minds and most innovative startups and want to claim ownership of the most outstanding patents to epitomize their culture and genius. New technologies promote a certain economic and societal model or lens through which to view the world. China knows this. Through its industrial rare metal strategy, it is betting heavily on scientific development, encouraging the creativity of its people, and ultimately cultivating an alternative civilization model to the tenets dictated by the West. And here's the sort of bent that I notice with the when I read this stuff of what the geopolitics and what's really behind how to sort of evaluate a country. The theoretical foundations of China's intellectual emulation were laid in 1976 when Deng Xiaoping broke ranks with Mao's agricultural ambitions to proclaim that from then on production power lay in the sciences. Subsequent leaders have perpetuated and deepened this conviction. In 2006, President Hu Jintao stated that science and technology form the central spread in the development strategy of China. Thus, concepts that were never central to Chinese history had become mantras of the state. So that, to me, is there you have it. You don't hear words like spirit, emotions, Mother Earth. You hear science and technology, economic strategies. To consolidate this vision, Beijing drew on the terrific competitive advantages of its economy, cheap labor from the inner provinces, cheap capital attributable to Chinese policy of devaluing the yuan, and the sheer size of the Chinese domestic market that allows significant economies of scale. Beijing also accelerated competing companies' relocation of their production facilities using partnership as its weapon. Under so-called joint ventures, foreign businesses gained access to the above-mentioned competitive advantages in exchange for their technological know-how and heretofore, and therefore their patents. Beijing called this absorption and internalizing of foreign technologies indigenous innovation. Wow, what a use of the indigenous innovation, but no mention of the actual indigenous peoples. And then a little farther forward, the plan is considered by many international technology companies as a blueprint for technology theft on a scale that the world has never seen. A U.S. report published in 2010 asserted, with these indigenous innovation industrial policies, it is very clear that China has switched from defense to offense. Then it mentions China, a leader in seven leading industries, many of which are considered green. Those industries are information technology, biology, aerospace, automation, energy, materials, and oceanography. The more recent Made in China 2025 plan saw the creation of some 40 industrial innovation hubs across the country. Wow, it sounds like, the first time I ever thought of that, sounds like Amazon. Sounds like the Amazon on steroids, which sounds like a ridiculous hyperbole. And here's where I have a good aspect of my spiritual path is flavored by the Taoist philosophy. So here I have that this is very un-Tao-like. Lastly, some of China's characteristics do little to aid its cause. While an interventionist regime may have allowed a strategic state to flourish, it leaves no room for any deviation. See, that is the Tao is about adapting and flowing. How can an administration that employs 2 million government agents to restrict online freedom of expression encourage creativity? A government that stymies the freedom to criticize and therefore to think differently, nurtures a potent culture of copying and turns the lack of inventiveness into a building block. The Chinese have the technology, but they are stuck in an organizational and intellectual logic that dates back to 1929, concluded a former Western diplomat posted to Beijing. And here's another one I've wondered about. The second challenge, survival of the Communist Party, is tacit agreement with one-fifth of humanity. The acceptance of an authoritarian regime in exchange for rising standards of living. Again, that to me sounds like America on steroids. Rare metals contribute one of the keys to the resilience of an authoritarian regime that must constantly innovate to avoid going the way of many imperial dynasties before it. In 2018, China filed a staggering 1.4 million patents. Oh my gosh, you know, wow. This earned China the title of the leading IT power globally. It has also put into orbit the first quantum communications satellite with reputedly impregnable encryption technology. Above all, China has taken the lead in an impressive range of green tech. It has put its image as a polluting and polluted country behind it to stand out as the world leader in green energy generation, the number one manufacturer of photovoltaic systems, the global hydropower giant, the biggest investor in wind power, and the world's largest market for clean energy vehicles. But that, as I've mentioned many times, if you read the book or watch the documentary or other such references, the bright green lies, that is bogus. How green it is super debatable. And here's something about the environment that he ends up this section of, so showing a different side. This ambitious ecological shift will also soothe growing tensions in China over environmental matters that have become unacceptable for the population. Indeed, anti-pollution protests now number between 30,000 to 50,000 every year. Have not seen much of that in the news. Anti-pollution protests now number between 30,000 and 50,000 every year. Whether protesting against a petrochemical complex project such as in the city of Kunming, Yunnan, or opposing the construction of a waste incinerator such as Hangzhou, Zhejiang, a middle-class movement aligned with the global NIMBY, not in my backyard trend, is openly rejecting the Chinese growth model. There are close to 8,000 environmental nonprofits working to harness, coordinate, and unify this groundswell. So I had just watched a video by Ben Bartee, B-A-R-T-E-E, and he was showing basically how China was all about the money first, and then, oh, wait a second, now we got to catch up and be green. So that's what this book is showing there, that they're trying to cover their proverbial. But again, I don't see that in the news. 8,000 environmental nonprofits working to help with that, to the environment. So a lot of these things batteries is pretty obvious. You got the magnets. I did not realize until this book how much the magnets are important. So that's one of the reasons given, justification for the attempts now at the lithium mining, and specifically Thacker Pass, Pehemaha, that in Nevada, that the U.S. is claiming, well, China's starting to take over the metals, so we need to, you know, save and be sustainable here at home. But that's geopolitically, economically sustainable, not care for the earth sustainable. And just wrapping up this chapter 6, because I have highlights for when he mentions the title. This consensus opposes another, that of Washington, which has prevailed since the end of the Cold War. The Beijing consensus, the idea that Chinese development model can serve as a benchmark for other emerging countries. This consensus opposes another, that of Washington, which has prevailed since the end of the Cold War, and by virtue of which economic growth and democratic progress are necessarily correlated. The war for rare metals and green jobs has therefore lifted the lid on a new ideological conflict that pits China's principles of political organization against those of the West. Clash of civilizations is a very Western way of seeing things, says Zhao Tingyang. He's a philosopher who became famous in China by popularizing Tianjia, a concept inspired by the teachings of Confucius, which promotes the search for harmony in international relations. And that leads to what I call Empire Light, which is that China is not starting military bases around the world and not making wars, although all this other stuff is another layer. So that's why I call it Empire Light. The Confucius thing will be a new era of power led by the globalization of communication and transport, which will unite a cosmopolitan ruling elite and share Western and Chinese values. So this is all. This is where I mind boggle with all the analysts talking about things, because it says it right there. The Western and Chinese, it favors the cosmopolitan. It favors the cities. It favors the elite. And it favors those dominant energies, without much mentioning of the minorities, the poor, the indigenous, the rural, the farmers, the mystics, the shamans. A corollary to this feel-good statement is the serenity of China's, quote, panda diplomacy, which involves gifting specimens of these giant folivores to countries with which it wishes to forge diplomatic ties. Beware of, it sounds like the Greeks bearing gifts, the Trojan horse. You would have to be heartless not to fawn over online videos of China's favorite furry mammal rolling about and eating bamboo. With the panda, China seeks to convey the idea of a peaceful emergence at all costs. It's tempting to believe in this, as it is to dream of an ethnically diverse world at peace. Except when the game is given away by one detail. By acquiring a strategic rare earths company in Indiana from under America's nose, China has whipped the covers off its impressive military program. So that's part three, because that ends the chapter, the day China overtook the West. So along with the this and the that of the metals, the book is showing the strategic aspects and the geopolitical race for who's on top. And that, of course, is part of the rare metals war. So there's two chapters left, so maybe can get that into part four, because that gets into the race for precision-guided missiles. Again, the military aspect, which certainly brings up the topic of war or potential war. And then the last chapter sums things up. So thanks for listening, and give thanks to the little metal bits and micro bits and batteries and metals that end in IUM that you can't pronounce. And thank those for conveying this these human and natural world concerns, so that the proverbial hearts and minds can hear and feel and think. So thanks for listening. Be well.